loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. After months of peaceful protests, the water protectors at Standing Rock were targeted for eviction by law enforcement and the government. But this struggle is not ending. It is going forward. Geneva peace talks aimed at ending Syria's nearly six-year-long war will reconvene today, more than a year after the last round ended unsuccessfully. Is there a new U.S. policy under Donald Trump? Are Iranian and Turkish relations also suddenly strained as Trump takes aim in Iran? And what might that mean for an end to the war in Syria? Secretary of State Rex Tillerson and Secretary of Homeland Security General John Kelly are in Mexico for 2 days of talks after President Nieto canceled his White House visit. The Mexican people are in the streets. They are angry, not just at Trump, but at their own government. Might there be a massive cross-border movement of protest and resistance? But first, we turn to the fight at Standing Rock against the Dakota Access Pipeline. We are joined from Montana by Candy Mossett, an activist with the Indigenous Environmental Network who has taken part in the actions at Standing Rock. Welcome back, Candy. The last time I talked to you, you were taking your three-year-old daughter, heading back to Standing Rock, making the stand, standing with all of those who have resisted the pipeline. Talk about what's going on right now and why it's happening.
So right now at the camps, there's a lot happening, and I actually have since taken Ayana, my daughter, away from there because of all of the police present and the guns. I mean, you could literally see them going down the hallways with their gun cases. They were staging at the Prairie Nights Casino, and it was just really an eerie thing to see highway patrol, state officers and troopers on the reservation side and staging at the casino and getting ready for today. Right now, we've been told that the deadline has been pushed back yet again to about 4 p.m. Central Standard Time.
Just so our audience, so it had been set at 2 p.m. Again, we're at 3:30 p.m. Central Time right now. So an hour and a half has passed and they've reset the deadline, but it's coming soon.
There have been no arrests that have been made on the ground yet. There have been people that have left and gone to higher ground to where there are other camps. The Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe camp, the Eagle's Nest camp above Sacred Stone, as well as the Seventh Generation Rising camp. So the people are going to continue to remain, but no arrests have been made. And from my understanding, there's about 60 people that are in Ocheti Shakoni camp right now that are just in prayer and ceremony and are just there peacefully waiting to see how it's going to play out. The police, the Army National Guard, the Army Corps of Engineers are all right now on Highway 1806 overlooking the camp. And people are just, it's almost like we're all just holding our breath. We're all just waiting to see what's going to happen on our end. It's very prayerful. It's very peaceful, very much the way we started, and are also looking forward to continuing the fight with the spirituality and the ceremony the way it all began. Because of this physical camp being moved doesn't mean that the battle, you know, doesn't continue, because we are looking at what's happening in the Bakken Shale oil formation, where the oil is actually coming from. The Dakota Access Pipeline being a symptom of that larger fight. We are still actively working on the just transition process to build with Standing Rock, which is our mini Wichoni sustained community, to be built on Standing Rock in a way that uses solar and wind and gray water systems, not only to show stopping a pipeline, but also showing what a just transition looks like. We're not naive in the way the world operates. We do use fossil fuel things. There are people that drive cars. What we're trying to do is change that so that we have options other than the ones that are basically crammed down our throats in the United States. We are told we have to have the combustion engine. That's not true. We are told we have to, you know, move off of our area and just deal with the way everything is today. It's kind of like business as usual. And that's not true. We have the power to fight back against a Republican-led Trump administration that is denying climate change and denying that we have a problem which is induced by humans. It's anthropogenic in our atmosphere. So this whole thing is much more than Ochetisha Kowin Camp, which is the physical place where this started. It continues in the ceremonial spiritual realm and in the fight to move away in a just transition from the fossil fuel industry to a clean, green energy economy.
We're speaking with Candy Mossett about the imminent, maybe imminent, shutdown by the police of the Standing Rock protest, the vigil that's gone on there for month after month after month, trying to stop the imposition on Indian land, on indigenous people's lands, of an oil pipeline not needed in order to satisfy the energy needs of the country, but satisfying the profit, making inducements of investors in the company. Donald Trump passed an executive order, introduced or announced an executive order shortly after taking the oath of office, allowing the pipeline to go forward along with the Keystone pipeline. Candy, you know, one thing that I heard an NPR story yesterday, National Public Radio, it was actually this morning. And it was so infuriating. It was like one of those insipid NPR stories where this young reporter, she's walking with a police official, and she says in this kind of chirpy voice, well, after months of violent protest, the officials here are worried now that the camp must be shut down in order to protect people from flooding. They're worried that the desperate people will resort to violence. I'm paraphrasing, but it was like that. I mean, the protesters, the water protectors, the people who live there, the people whose land it is, they have not been violent. They have been peaceful, and they have been the targets of extreme violence, pepper spray, dogs ripping them apart. I mean, talk about that.
It is a sad chapter in American history, which exists in the larger book of American history. This country, the United States of America, is founded on the taking, raping, and pillaging of the native lands. And ever since the beginning, throughout the history books, they have always painted and depicted us, the natives, as the bad ones. We were always depicted as the violent ones. We were always depicted as the dirty ones. And you would think that we would learn from our history. But no, that is still occurring. It's not what happened to the Native American people here. It's what's continuing to happen to us and our children today. We've never changed our narrative about how we have to care for the land if we are to expecting the land to care for us. And so it's easier for the propaganda machines of the media and the climate deniers of a Trump presidency to try to paint us as violent and depict us as the problem. They're trying to say that we are the ones that are going to pollute the land because of our little camp there, totally disregarding the huge drill pad on top of the hill and all of the carcinogenic chemicals that are flowing through that oil pipeline. And so we remain steadfast in what we've always shared about us and our culture, which is that we as humanity are looking at the possible extinction of humanity if business as usual continues, because the earth will go on. She'll shake us off like an old batch of fleas on a dog and she'll heal. But whether or not humans will be here is the question, because we need clean air to breathe. We need clean water to drink, and we need soil that's not contaminated to grow our food. And by continuing to combust fossil fuels, we are continuing to destroy those very natural resources that we need as humanity to live on this planet. And if you look 200 years ago to the quote-unquote Industrial Revolution, you'll see where the increase in temperature started in our planet. You'll see where greenhouse gas emissions started to change the Earth systems and Earth cycles. That is something that we as humanity are responsible for, and that is something that us Native American people in this fight at Standing Rock and in the larger fight of a just transition are trying to steer us away from and say, our narrative hasn't changed for over 500 years. When are you going to listen? And luckily, a lot of people are in this day and age, but you still have those spinsters that want to continue to move forward in an ignorant way, saying that the fossil fuel industry is our only option, which we know not to be true.
We're speaking with Candy Mossett. We're talking to her from Montana. She's been at Standing Rock. She's part of the Indigenous Environmental Network. There's a lot of drama right now as we're recording this show. The government has moved back the deadline where they said they would clear everyone, the water protectors who were at Standing Rock, by 2 p.m. Central Time. Now it is 3:47 Central Time. They have not been cleared, but the government has now said at 4 o'clock Central Time they will be cleared, so people may be arrested. Given the history of police violence and violence from the state against peaceful protesters, we don't know what will happen. In other words, there's a lot of suspense right now, a lot of drama. But Candy, the thing that you're emphasizing, which I think is so, so important for our audience, is the idea that no matter what happens in the next hour or in the next 2 hours, this fight is not ending. It's really not ending. Prior to the camp being cleared, or the announcement that it would be cleared, an article from the Intercept magazine or website quoted a 90-year-old water protector, someone who's there, as saying, quote, "They don't understand. We will not back down. We have our ancestors with us, and we are in prayer that Tunkashila, Great Spirit in Lakota, will guide us in our freedom." That's a quote. In other words, this isn't the end. This is not the end of this Native-led resistance to destructive pipelines.
Oh, by no means. It's only the beginning, and Tunkashila is watching, and we know that with the next potential 4 years of this Trump administration, we have a lot of work ahead of us, but it really is sparking a revolution. And by Standing Rock happening, by water protectors fighting back against this one single pipeline, it has really, I think, had an awakening for the rest of the country to say that if it can, you know, if a small group of people can do it there and be as successful as they've been, why can't we? That's the important thing about this fight and this struggle, is that it sparks so many other people to actually do something and to take action in their own communities around how to make their own communities better. And that's what it's about. It's not about going to any one physical location. It's about where you are in your hometowns and what you can do as individuals to change the narrative of business as usual. And so collectively, we have the power as human beings to make that change. We can defund these projects, these fossil fuel projects, by our own banks. We can divest away from large banks that fund these fossil fuel projects, and we can put our money into local community credit unions. We don't give ourselves nearly as much credit as we have as individual people. And so we have the ongoing campaign, defunddapple.org, where you can find the 17 banks that are funding these projects. But indeed, you can look at the big picture problem, which is that industry controls the country right now, especially with a Trump presidency, which is Republican-led, because he is being played by the Koch brothers. And the Koch brothers are all about industry, capitalism, continued growth without any repercussion for what might happen as a result of that continued growth. And that's a very, very, very dangerous place for us to be in society today. So remember that even though the status quo is that you have to have a combustion engine now, and that you have to rely on fossil fuels, there is a different way. There is a better way that exists. And that's what we're talking about, is transitioning to that way of away from the combustion engine, away from the large industry that controls us, and living on this planet in a much more delicate and balanced fashion that we are now, instead of consuming as much energy as we do as a nation, to look at where we can downsize the amount of energy that's just completely wasted for no reason, which is causing problems. I don't know if people watch television that much. A lot of my friends don't. But when I turn on the TV, I see these Cancer Treatment Centers of America, you know, all the time. And people aren't making that connection between health and environment. And why are so many people sick? It's because we're poisoning ourselves. And people want options. American people are hungry for options of having a solar panel outside their house that they can plug their electric car into, instead of having to waste energy and fuel and through a combustion engine. People want to have options, but instead what's being subsidized is the fossil fuel industry, especially now with this Republican, the Trump administration, which is it's an outrage. And yeah. It should be, everybody should be outraged and should speak up. We are going to Washington, D.C. the week of March 7th through the 10th. We are continuing this fight on the lawn of the Capitol, where we're going to have a teepee encampment set up to show them that we're still here, regardless if you evict us from Ocheti Shacoin camp. We're not going anywhere. We're still here. You can evict us out of a physical place all you want, but the spirituality and ceremony and the fight that started continues. So join us in Washington, D.C. We're going to do lobby day visits to our congressmen the 7th, 8th, and 9th. We're going to have programming the 7th, 8th, and 9th in our teepee encampment. That's all culminating in a march and rally on the 10th in Washington, D.C., where it's called Native Nations Rise. You can find more information at nativenationsrise.org. Continue to stand with us, because this is just the beginning of a long battle for us to save ourselves.
Okay, we're going to leave it there. We've been talking from Montana with Candy Mossett. She's an activist with the Indigenous Environmental Network. We're recording this today. Now it is 4:52 East Coast time, 3:52 Central, just moments away from when the government says they are going to clear the last water protectors from Standing Rock. We'll see, of course, what happens. But whatever happens today, whatever happens tomorrow, as Candy Mossett has said, the struggle is not ending. People will be coming to Washington, D.C. on March 7th, I believe. Is that right, Candy? March 7th?
It begins March 7th, and the actual march and rally is on the 10th.
Okay, we'll leave it right there. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Geneva peace talks aimed at ending Syria's nearly six-year-long war will reconvene today, more than a year after the last round ended unsuccessfully. Is there a new U.S. policy under Donald Trump? Are Iranian-Turkish relations also suddenly strained as Trump takes aim at Iran? And what might that mean for an end to the war in Syria? We are joined from Scotland by John White. He is the host of Radio Sputnik's weekly show, Hard Facts. Welcome back, John White.
Hi, Brian. Good to be with you again.
Thanks for joining. Geneva talks are beginning once again. This is the Geneva talks about Syria, of course. The last round was started on February 1st of 2016, a year ago, but that only lasted for 3 days before breaking down. Things have changed a lot in the last year, a whole lot. Is there optimism now? Is there more optimism? What's changed in the past year? What's your assessment?
Well, I think there are certainly grounds for cautious optimism, but there are also grounds for concern, given the recent statement by the president of the Syrian National Council, Anas al-Abda. He spoke at a sub-meeting at the Munich Security Conference at the weekend, and he again confirmed that as far as his organization is concerned, there will be no peace in Syria with Assad in power. So that does not augur well for the upcoming talks in Geneva. But however, we also have quite a significant development with regard to the CIA announcement that is to cease funding of the Free Syrian Army. Now, people obviously can speculate as to the reasoning for this. They have cited the fact that there have been a number of Islamist attacks against Free Syrian Army positions, and they're worried that the money that they've been sending, the arms, etc., could be falling into the wrong hands. But it does give us cause to speculate that this could be part of a shift on the part of Washington with the Trump administration. And obviously the timing of this development in advance, just as the Geneva talks are upon us, could be significant. But I think I would err on the side of caution, because we're getting mixed messages from Washington and the Trump administration with regards to its policy towards Russia. Mike Pence recently took a hard line on events in Ukraine, which resulted in Vladimir Putin signing a decree to recognize the travel documents and other documentation issued by the unilaterally declared Donetsk and Luhansk People's Republics in eastern Ukraine. obviously sending a strong message in that regard. So we have to see what happens in Geneva. It's going to be a real test for the Trump administration when it comes to its stance towards Syria. And I suppose the major question is what their position is on regime change. Is it off the table in Washington? Do they accept the legitimacy of the Assad government? And I think everything will flow from that central question.
John White, help the audience understand what the difference is in terms of the process, the actual process between the talks in Kazakhstan, the Astana talks in the capital of Kazakhstan, resulting in a ceasefire. And significant parts of the ceasefire seem to be holding. What's the difference between those peace talks and the peace talks in Geneva?
Well, the major difference is the non-participation at the Astana talks of the United States. These talks were set up just between Trump assuming office and Obama leaving office on January 20th. And they're significant because they involved Turkey and they involved representatives of the Syrian opposition sitting down in the same room for the first time with representatives of the Syrian government. And a very significant development at those talks was the new draft constitution that was produced by the Russians, which they handed to Syrian opposition representatives for consideration. It was unsurprisingly rejected, and understandably in a sense from their point of view, because the way that they say it was imposed from outside the country. Clearly, ideally, such a constitution would arise from a constitutional convention called within the country by all the contending parties, and then the constitution would be agreed upon out of that process. But we don't have ideal conditions in Syria. But the constitution itself was very, very bold in the sense that it enshrines fixed terms for the presidency. It drops the word Arab from the country's name. So we now go from the Syrian Arab Republic to the Syrian Republic, thereby embracing the status of the country's non-Arab minorities, specifically the Kurds, offering the Kurds cultural autonomy. It enshrines in law the right of a non-Muslim to become president of the country. It was a real test, actually, for the government, given some of the provisions that were included. But it was roundly rejected, and I think because clearly the opposition were still looking to see what Washington's position would be. They've been able in the past to use Washington as a leverage against Russia, and thereby to continue the conflict, hoping that enough pressure would be brought to bear on Assad and the Russians to change their view on Assad's future. Now, Russia clearly cannot have an open-ended commitment in Syria. I'm not saying that they're ready to leave. They clearly will be there for quite some considerable time, but they're obviously looking for an end game. So the difference in these talks were obviously the fact that the US was not there because Washington was in transition between the Obama administration and the incoming Trump administration. So we'll see how this plays out in Geneva. The burning question is Trump's position and the stance that his administration takes when it comes to these talks and where it takes us going forward.
Indeed. I want to go into some of the different players and how their perhaps changing positions may impact on these talks or the situation in Syria going forward, including the evolving relations between Turkey and Iran. I want to talk about that in a minute. But I've talked to Syrian government supporters who are Syrians on this show, and they too reject the Russian proposed constitution. They reject the idea of making the Syrian Republic be something other than the Syrian Arab Republic, not because they say they need to discount or hide or make invisible national minority peoples. They believe that Syria has not done that anyway, but they have opposition to that. And they also believe that the Russian proposal may have fit more in the Russian Federation and in the, you know, pre-Russian Federation within the Soviet Union, but less so for Syria. In other words, there may be all kinds of differences of opinion on both sides. But the other thing that these people who I interviewed said was that the Russians were offering it as a proposal. They weren't actually trying to impose it on Syria. And I agree with you. I think it's less important about what words are in the Constitution, although the words are important in terms of how a post-war Syria might be configured. But what's more important, as you have said rightly, is what's the attitude of the Washington government, of the new government, of the Trump administration? It's made up of a lot of generals now. It's hardcore, hardliners. It's not just Pence, who spoke at Munich Security Conference. Mattis has taken a hard line. Rex Tillerson, Mike Pompeo. I mean, these people are like really mainstream right-wing militarists in the United States. And there's a lot of continuity, I would say, between their positions and the positions during the Obama administration. So that remains to be to play out. But talk about, if you would, because I think there's a lot of confusion. I know there is here. Who is the Syrian National Council? It's one thing for the CIA to say, well, we're not funding anymore the Free Syrian Army. That might be somewhat symbolic, because who is the Free Syrian Army? I mean,
well, they don't exist in any meaningful form.
But who is the meaningful opposition outside of Daesh and outside of Al-Qaeda? Talk about who that is.
There is none. That is the brutal answer. I interviewed 2 weeks ago on my show, Hard Facts, I interviewed Britain's former ambassador to Syria, Peter Ford. He was the ambassador in the country between 2003 and 2006. We were discussing the Amnesty International report alleging mass war crimes being committed by Syrian government at Saidnaya prison just outside Damascus. And in the context of that interview, we discussed the Astana talks and the new draft constitution that the Russians produced. And he was scathing about the so-called moderate, the so-called official Syrian opposition who exist outside the country, the Syrian National Council mainly. He said they represent no one in Syria. They have no influence on the ground. They are not connected in any meaningful sense to events on the ground. And he does not believe that they are interested in democracy. He now believes that we're looking at Sunni supremacy. That is what the dividing line is between a sectarian Syrian state, a Sunni caliphate, if you will, perhaps of different gradation depending on which group achieves power, and a non-sectarian state, which the existing Syrian government represents and is fighting for along with its allies. So he's scathing of the Syrian opposition. He thinks that the presumption that they represent anyone in Syria is an insult to the Syrian people, especially the people who've been engaged in the conflict. And I agree with him. Everything that I've seen, everything that I've read following the conflict over the last 6 years, it leads me to believe that it's now a straight choice between Syria being preserved as a non-sectarian, multi-religious, multicultural, secular state under Bashar al-Assad, certainly in the short to medium term, and the country becoming a Salafi jihadist state, with the clock turned back to the 7th century in service to religious extremism, sectarianism and obscurantism. And I think as soon as we understand that reality, and Washington understands that reality and acts upon that reality, as the Russians, I think, do understand that reality, then we'll see meaningful progress. As of now, this will still be resolved on the ground. There's still a lot of fighting to be done. And I don't think it's possible, to be honest with you, that this can be resolved at the negotiating table at this point. The conflict's been going on too long. It's been so brutal. The enmity on both sides is so deep. I don't see how it can be resolved at the negotiating table. So this is where Washington has to come into play. How serious are they? First of all, is regime change off the table? And if it is, they have to stop all funding and support of all groups, so-called moderate groups that they've been funding and supporting. But more importantly, they have to start bringing serious pressure to bear on their regional allies, and I'm talking about the Gulf states of Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Kuwait, who continue to fund various Salafi jihadist groups. Until they do that, cut off that oxygen, then they are not serious about resolving this conflict.
That's the voice of John White. He is a political commentator. He's also the show host of Hard Facts on Radio Sputnik. John, I want to talk to you again about, as I alluded earlier, to the relationship between Turkey and Iran, because at the Kazakhstan peace talks and over the last months, as Turkey's relations with Russia have improved, there has become a new axis. It's Russia, it's Turkey, it's Iran. They were, as they announced, the guarantors of a peace process. Now relations between Turkey and Iran, who are, again, the main sponsors of the talks between the Syrian government and the opposition, they've worsened in recent days. Last week, Turkish President Erdogan said during a visit to Bahrain, quote, some people want both Iraq and Syria to be divided. There are some that are working hard to divide Iraq. There is a sectarian struggle, a Persian nationalism at work there. This Persian nationalism is trying to divide the country. We need to block this effort. The next day, the Iranian Foreign Ministry responded with a statement that read, among regional leaders, no one more so than Mr. Erdogan is aware of Iran's constructive role in the region, especially in Iraq. It is concerning that terrorist organizations in the region are being supported directly or indirectly to destabilize neighboring countries. I mean, these are words of, growing animosity, growing enmity. Do you think it's possible that Turkey, which has been swinging back and forth, could swing back into the Assad must go camp? What do you think about that?
I think that's a strong possibility. I think Erdogan's clear by now is an opportunist of the highest order. You're right, he has swung back and forth. I think he's worried about his, there's a large constituency of sympathizer or sympathy within Turkey for various Salafi jihadi groups, including, I think, within the Turkish deep state. Obviously, we know that for many years, ISIS and other groups were receiving direct aid from elements within the Turkish deep state. The country's border was a de facto revolving door through which men, materiel and supplies was moving. There was oil that was stolen from Syrian oil fields was being transported through Turkey to be sold on the black market, which helped to sustain ISIS. So Erdogan, I think, is an opportunist. I think he senses that the political weather is changing with regard, or the geopolitical weather is changing with regard to Washington's stance towards Iran. Trump's belligerence towards Iran has been a central point of his foreign policy, certainly his foreign policy statements. Very belligerent to the point where the Iranians are preparing for war, because it's unconscionable. The Iranian foreign minister is absolutely right. Iran has been a strong pillar of in opposition to terrorism. So the real cognitive dissonance coming from Washington with regards to Iran, obviously they have an eye on the relationship with the Saudis. It's significant that Saudi nationals were not placed on this Muslim ban, this travel ban that was drawn up by Trump recently, but Iranian nationals were. And obviously Trump, we saw his cringeworthy joint press conference with Benjamin Netanyahu recently in Washington. So there's real cause for concern on that score when it comes to how this will impact on the policy towards Syria. Because you can't obviously make an enemy of Iran if you're keen to foment positive relations with Russia with regard to fighting terrorism in Syria and in the wider region. So I think Erdogan's detecting this shift in political weather. And given his opportunism, I think his main concern is the survival of his own government, given events in Turkey over the past year. So I do suspect that it's tailored towards the change in weather and the hostility that's been emanating from Washington under Trump towards the Iranians.
I agree with you. A complex picture, and it doesn't get less complex, even as the battlefield situation has shifted in a way that's been very favorable for the Syrian government. But yes, again, the wild card is Washington. We'll have to see what the Trump foreign policy really looks like, because let's face it, at this point, we actually don't know what the Trump foreign policy is. We've been talking with John White. He's a political commentator. He's also the show host of Radio Sputnik's weekly show, Hard Facts. I encourage our audience to check out Hard Facts. Thank you, John White. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson and Secretary of Homeland Security General John Kelly are in Mexico for 2 days of talks after President Nieto canceled his White House visit last month. Is there any chance that the badly damaged U.S.-Mexico relations will improve? We are joined by James Cockcroft, the founder of the Network of Intellectuals, Artists, and Social Movements in Defense of Humanity. He is the author of Mexico's Revolution, Then and Now, available from Monthly Review Press. described by reviewers as a landmark and an unrivaled classic and a key to understanding Mexico. Welcome, James Cockcroft.
Well, thank you for having me, Brian.
Yeah, thank you for joining. Mexico's foreign minister said yesterday Mexico would not accept Trump administration's new U.S. immigration proposals, saying that Mexico will go to the United Nations if need be to defend the rights of immigrants in the U.S. Now, this is what the Guardian newspaper says. Luis Videgaray, Mexico's foreign minister, was responding to Donald Trump's plans to enforce immigration rules more vigorously against undocumented immigrants, which could lead to mass deportations to Mexico, not just of Mexicans, but also citizens of other Latin American countries. Quote, "We are not going to accept it because we don't have to accept it," Mexico's foreign minister said. "I want to make it clear in the most emphatic way that the government of Mexico and the Mexican people do not have to accept measures that one government wants to unilaterally impose on another. This is a moment of definition. The decisions we make in the coming months will determine how Mexico and the United States coexist for the next decades." Those are strong words. Go ahead, James.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And what you have to do is take those words with a grain of salt, because the Mexican government for decades now has been kowtowing to the U.S. government, or at least the powers behind the U.S. government, which is the transnational corporations setting up the maquiladoras in Mexico, those factories that exploit cheap Mexican labor. And this has escalated during the NAFTA period. So the Mexican government has basically always tried to sound nationalist, because that was the theme of its original revolution way back when in the early 20th century. And that revolution's been betrayed basically for the last 60 or 70 years. It's been a sellout basically to the United States, which is what that book that you referred to, my book with Monthly Review Press, Mexico's Revolution Then and Now, documents. So if you understand that, first of all, you'll go a long ways towards understanding future U.S.-Mexico relations. The other thing, two things we have to understand, in my opinion, Brian, it's just my opinion, but a lot of people agree with me, I'm happy to say, is that Mexico is part of a larger crisis in both Mexico and the United States, and indeed the world. And that crisis involves the rest of Latin America, which has been declared a zone of peace by the new unity among Latin American governments, even reactionary governments like Mexico's, that was established a few years ago with the founding of CELAC, the Confederation of Latin American and Caribbean States, which is excluding, of course, the USA and Canada. It's an alternative to the OAS, Organization of American States, which has always been a fig leaf of U.S. imperialism. So even reactionary governments in Latin America are pretty tense now with the deterioration in, or the ostensible deterioration in, U.S.-Mexico relations, because it involves possible military intervention, and certainly it involves tension with not just the present government of the United States, but the preceding one. If you give me 1 minute, I'd like just to quote a sentence from my book on the building of the wall. Would you like to hear it?
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I wrote this 7 years ago, but here's what it says. I'm put on my reading glasses here, and it's ironic. I just ran across it today because, you know, everyone's talking about Trump's wall, but here's what I was talking about back then. I was mentioning they were constructing a wall along the U.S.-Mexico border under Obama. And it was a wall, quote, "larger and worse than any wall in human history. And it constitutes a key part of the intended fourth conquest of Mexico, an economic and cultural conquest imposed by neoliberalism and racism, the four conquests being a Spanish conquest followed by the U.S. invasion of 1846-1848 that took half of Mexico's territory away from it, including California and so on. And the third conquest was the French occupation of Mexico shortly afterwards, which the Mexicans defeated in guerrilla combat. So that's the historical context that I feel is really important, Brian, when we raise all these questions about the weekly news developments like the latest.
I hear you. I mean, Mexico is a big country. I think it's the 10th or 11th largest country in the world. It has 120 million people. It does about $580 billion in trade every year with the United States. More than $1.4 billion in commerce takes place across the U.S.-Mexican border every day. What do you think about what Trump is doing? Because even though the Nieto government and the other governments that have been in power in Mexico, certainly since the heyday of the Cardenas government in the 30s, I would say, which was a left nationalist government, not communist, not, you know, like Cuba's revolution, say, today, but a nationalist government. It nationalized the oil. But the governments that have come since have been acquiescing or appeasing the U.S. over and over again. But there is public opinion. There's 120 million Mexicans. They must be angry and demanding that their government do something. Can they make it do something?
Well, they're rising up all over Mexico in every single state. Ever since the straw that's breaking the camel's back occurred last month in January, the so-called Gasolazo uprising is a protest in the streets, very spontaneous, not particularly well organized, against the 20% hike in gas prices. Itself a product of the privatization of that nationalized oil industry that you mentioned from the 1930s under Cardenas. And as a result, Mexico has lost control of the pricing mechanisms on oil for its own country. And it used the nationalized oil before it got privatized to sponsor development programs, some of which had modest success, indeed creating that powerful trading partner before NAFTA that Mexico became with the United States. But all that is water under the bridge at this point, because now Mexicans are more poor than they were when NAFTA began in 1994. The poverty rate's 55% now. And they're really without decent jobs whatsoever. More than 2 million had to lose their plots of land because of NAFTA and became a semi-employed workforce, both in the migratory flow to the north, but also inside the big Mexican cities, where poverty reigns supreme, of course. So you have this crisis, and it's really a crisis of legitimacy of the Mexican government itself and its political system. Now, I might add, a similar crisis of legitimacy exists in the United States. So you have both countries that we're talking about today, as well as several others, I might add, around the world, in a crisis of legitimacy, their governments. And the capitalist system itself is in a crisis of legitimacy, because it's that system of big capital that's behind the governments we're talking about that calls the shots. So we're not sure where it's all going to go, are we, Brian?
Well, if the Mexican government, under siege from mass protests, spontaneous protests that have been taking place, as you mentioned, James, for the past month because of rising oil prices, rising gas prices, if that government wants to do something that appeals to the masses of people, of irate, angry, unhappy Mexicans, they could, in fact, take a nationalist stance and go to the United Nations, for instance. I mean, in other words, make this issue, the issue of Mexicans and other people, but people who would have had to go through Mexico being sort of targeted for deportation, for detention, for mass deportation, take it to the United Nations. That could be one thing that they might do. The other thing is there's tens of thousands of migrants. This is something else that the Guardian newspaper has pointed out, mostly from Central America, meaning Guatemala, Honduras, in other words, south of Mexico. but increasingly further afield. They transit Mexico annually in attempts to reach the U.S. border. Mexico has been the enforcer imposing the southern border plan, its own southern border plan in 2014, to detain and deport migrants transiting Mexican territory on their way to the United States. They could start to just open the doors and let people pass. What do you think?
Oh, they're not going to do that. They already announced, and just shortly, I forget whether it was a week ago or a few days ago, that they're closing off that border with Guatemala. So not even the train that the migrants have been taking, the so-called bestia or beast, from the border north to the U.S. border, from the Guatemala-Mexico border north, will be able to be boarded anymore by those migrants. So don't forget that Mexico's always had a two-faced policy when it came to treatment of migrants. This is nothing new in Mexican history. Just as the United States has had a two-faced policy now and then, you know, doing something liberal and nice, but mostly the one face in the case of the United States. In any case, the UN is a rather weak institution these days, if you haven't noticed, and cannot be counted on to make a key difference. In diplomatic circles, it'll help Mexico to take it to the UN, no doubt about that. However, the real threat, again, is from the people rising up in Mexico and in the United States. Now, these are spontaneous resistance movements that we're seeing in both countries, led in many cases by women. And in the case of the United States, not just women, but immigrants, racial minorities, Black Lives Matter, indigenous peoples, the Sioux in fighting the pipelines that the new president is endorsing and renewing after the Sioux had won their battle a few months before the election last fall. So these battles continue. The Vietnam veterans against the war, or Iraq veterans against the war, are there again in Sioux country, putting their bodies between the Sioux and the armed militia of the U.S. government, who are a threat to the Sioux in that region. So this sort of emergent unity in the United States between all the different forces, I've only mentioned a few of the movements, there are obviously many, including the immigrant movement itself, which had a day without immigrants recently that was nationwide. And restaurants closed, businesses closed. The immigrants said, see what it's like not to have us working for you. And now they're threatening a general strike, including participation of labor unions in the United States, for May Day in the United States.
Yeah, that would be really something. Of course, in 2006, in the face of Sensenbrenner's provocation, whereby the legislation he introduced in the U.S. Congress meant to create criminals, felons, out of all people who did not have papers here, in the unlikely circumstance whereby this most oppressed sector of the U.S. working class was able to rally, organize, and finally carry out what I believe is probably one of the biggest political general strikes of sorts in May Day 2006. It could happen again, James Cockruff, and it could happen on both sides of the border. I mean, that would really, really be something. We're talking with James Cockruff. He is an author, and he's the author of a recent book published by Monthly Review Press called Mexico's Revolution Then and Now. You can go to Monthly Review's website and order the book. It's been his book has been hailed by reviewers as a landmark, an unrivaled classic. Certainly the Trump administration's posture towards Mexico and absolute provocation will stimulate more struggle, James, in Mexico, as we know, in the United States, there's, you know, perhaps as many as 20% of the population here has taken part in protests in recent months. But let's talk about
And easily that in Mexico as well. And let me just add that if these movements don't unify, not just internally in each country, but internationally with one another, there's not a heck of a lot of a chance of their succeeding. And they will be repressed, make no mistake about it. And if they unify, it'll be harder to repress them because they'll be unifying across that border and internationally. And believe me, a lot of other social movements in defense of immigrant and labor rights will join them from the rest of the world. In other words, it has potential to be just too much for either the Mexican or the American government or the U.S. government to handle. But if they don't unify, especially internally, but also internationally, then I'm afraid it's going to be very hard on all of them. But as you know, it's hard on all of those immigrants and the American workers who have been with inadequate wages for two or three generations now, not just under Obama, but the preceding generations, ever since Ronald Reagan introduced neoliberalism. You know, life is not easy, and people are beginning to wake up that they've got to organize themselves and cooperate with each other to change the situation. And the situation is represented at this point by an illegitimate government in both countries, and all the polls show that, and certainly the latest election process in the United States showed it for the U.S. people, too, that they just don't believe in their government anymore.
We're gonna have to leave it there. James, I would like to invite you back to talk more about Mexico's internal situation in the coming weeks. We're going to keep following this story. We've been talking with James Cockcroft, the founder of the Network of Intellectuals, Artists, and Social Movements in Defense of Humanity. He is the author of Mexico's Revolution, Then and Now, which you can purchase from Monthly Review Press. Thank you, James Cockcroft. We will be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and you want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear.